Cole got a pair of pistols and a box of shells and walked off a distance from the house. He took aim at an old peach can that lay, rusted, a dozen yards away and set to shooting it because a man who makes his living by using a gun needs to keep his skills finely tuned. It was no different than a violinist who practices for hours each day. The pop and crack of his revolvers drew the others from the cabin. Preacher Man and Tom, and even old Pablo, who'd left the refuge of the shed now that the marshal had ridden off. Charlie came swinging on his crutches. Soon enough, they were all firing their weapons at that old peach can, causing it to jump and dance like something alive. Franzetta watched from the doorway of the cabin. She hated to admit to herself that there was something powerful about men firing guns together for a common cause. She admired Charlie greatly, but truth be told, it was John Henry Cole who fascinated her the most. She had never before felt it as strongly as she did just then, not even during their brief encounter before Charlie came along. But lately she'd begun to think about Cole more and more, and felt herself being irresistibly drawn to him, even to the point of hoping he would look at her in a certain way so that she could tell he was thinking about her in that way. And if so, perhaps at least he'd be willing to talk to her in private about it. But thus far, Cole had seemed to ignore her, had avoided being around her alone. He was polite but distant, and it made her all the more want to be with him.
Maybe I'm just being foolish. It's just the stress and fear of what might happen. It has nothing to do with seeing Charlie hobbling around on crutches like some old man.
Since Charlie'd been shot, they had not made love. He hadn't touched her. Getting shot seemed to have aged him 10 years. There was already a 15-year difference in their ages. She could understand how a man hurting doesn't have such things as making love to his wife on his mind, but understanding it didn't mean that she accepted it.
Damn you, John Henry, for being who you are. Why couldn't you have loved me the way Charlie does?
Of the men firing their guns, Cole stood the tallest, his shoulders the broadest. His was the longest shadow cast over the ground. Cole was the looming figure among them all, and it was he on whom her gaze was fixed. He who caused her to have such crazy thoughts.
If Charlie and I don't get gone from this place, and gone soon, I don't know what might happen.
She would speak with Charlie that night, in bed once the others were asleep. She would tell him what they must do, and make him do it. Her hands trembled, and she turned away from the doorway. She went to lie down on the bed, trying not to think of John Henry Cole. But think of him she did, and soon, more than her hands trembled. They stepped off the train in Ardmore, a dog-spit place full of lurking types, men with watchful eyes. Black Bill looked about amid the steam and chuff of the train's big black engine.
Opportunists.
They walked two by two down the street toward the center of town, Sam and Shorty in front, Atticus and Bill behind. Sam Starr had said he had a friend who owned a saloon, the Hair of the Dog, if he hadn't sold out or been killed. And if Mace Eddings was still around, he'd have a lead on finding some gun hands. There wasn't anything to distinguish Ardmore from a dozen other towns in the nations. It was just a place to get a whiskey if you weren't an Indian, or get a woman, or a card game. There was a hotel and several saloons and a couple of cat houses. There was also the usual hardware store. Two, to be exact, and medical offices, both dentist and doctor, a small infirmary, a three-cell jail made of brick, and a bank.
This is the place.
Sam turned to the saloon and stepped inside. The others followed. It was not yet noon, and there was hardly anyone in the place. It had sawdust on the puncheon floors, a tin-stamped ceiling, a long oak bar to the right, with shelves holding bottles of whiskey, gin, and other liquors. Three beer taps and a double back bar mirror. There were tables and chairs toward the back under mounted buffalo heads and one of an antelope. There was currently no indication of the rowdy nights when men crowded the bar to drink and laugh and gamble and fight. All was quiet. Mace Eddings stood behind the bar, reading the latest issue of Harper's Weekly about the assassination and subsequent death of President Garfield, how the poor man had suffered for weeks. Eddings looked up at the entrance of Sam Starr and the others. What he saw, he didn't care for. He instantly thought of the sawed-off double barrel he kept under the bar, the one he had used when he was a stage messenger. The only thing he'd ever shot with it was coyotes. He was by nature a peaceable man, although he hadn't always been so. There had been a time when he'd been a prize fighter and had the face to prove it. Nowadays, however, he considered himself a legitimate businessman who did not water down the drinks and gave fair measure. He brooked no fights inside the bar and had an oak billy club filled with lead in case a fist didn't do it and a shotgun was too much.
Mace.
The men bellied up to the bar.
Sam.
See, you're still wetting their whistles.
Plainly.
How about around for me and my boys?
What's your poison?
How about your best whiskey and a beer back for me and the boys?
The barkeep poured and stood watching as they took their time tossing them back before going to work on the beers.
What brings you boys to Ardmore?
Looking for the Cox brothers. They around?
Yeah, could be.
I'd like to offer them jobs.
You plan on starting your own army?
Oh, that's a thought. But no, I just have a job that requires more than the four of us. The reason I come here to talk to you was to see if you could put me onto those boys. I worked with them before.
So I heard.
There was a visible tension between the two men. Mace would just as soon they hit the road and was not overly forthcoming until Sam Starr took $50 of that stolen bank money and counted it out right there atop the wood.
For your trouble, Mace. Might be more where that came from.
Yeah, I might know where they're at.
You want to go round them up and bring them back here?
I'd lose money if everybody who walked through that door wanted me to run errands for them.
Sam put another $50 atop the wood.
Just set the bottle here while you go get them.
Mace scooped up the money and stuffed it in his waistcoat pocket. He hadn't wanted any truck with Sam Starr, but those greenbacks argued differently with him. Those greenbacks spoke a language all their own.
Gippy!
A fellow who'd been sitting at a table came up from the back, limping on a stiff leg.
Watch the bar while I'm gone.
Sure, boss.
Sort of looks like one-eyed, don't he? The way he's hamstrung.
Mace left. Half an hour passed.
The boys are horned up. What's a good hog farm?
Well, there's two here in town. One out of town a couple of miles. You want fat or skinny or white or Chinese?
Hell, if it matters.
Sam looked at the others. Only Atticus Creed seemed disinterested. The outlaw life had worn thin on him.
Well, then, I'd recommend Miss Patsy's. She got a good variety, keeps her girls clean by having Doc Peters check them out about once a month.
Doc Peters? Now, that's a hell of a handle for a man who checks out beaver to see if it's clean or not.
Again, all but Atticus joined in on the humor.
Point the way.
It's down t'other end of town, opposite the dentist's office.
Good. Let's go, boys.
I'll stay here. Wait for the barkeep and the Cox brothers.
The others left.
Got any coffee? My head's swimming, and I don't rightly like not being in my right mind.
I'll fix up a pot.
When he had done it, he brought Atticus a cup and set it there on the wood.
Sounds like you boys got something working. I'd be available for a job of any kind if you boys is hiring.
Atticus looked at the thin face with its bulging eyes.
I ain't got no say in it.
Well, shit, fire, fella. I could use me some extra work. I ain't above breaking the law, neither.
You ought to get on away from me now, mister.
Oh, sure, mister.
Gimpy went to the far end of the bar, and Atticus took his coffee cup and went and sat at a table. A few minutes later, Mace and the Cox brothers entered. Atticus had heard about them, but never before had laid eyes on either one. They looked like cowpunchers the way they were dressed. Sweat-stained sombreros, jackets over waistcoats over striped shirts, with big kerchiefs draped around their necks, filthy dungarees tucked down into the shafts of rough, low-heeled boots. Atticus studied them. He could see by the bulges under their coats they were armed. Their faces and hands were dark from sun and wind, and the skin around their cheeks was as shiny as wax. One had a heel-over scar that ran from his ear to his jaw. They wore kidskin gloves and pulled them off and tucked them inside their gun belts in order to drink. They looked about the bar cautiously, the way men who are either on the prod or on the dodge will do. Their gaze came to rest on Atticus and lingered there for a moment, then shifted back to the gimpy barkeep and their own images in the back bar mirror.
Where'd Star go?
They went over to Miss Patsy's.
Mace walked over to Atticus.
I thought you boys wanted to do business with these fellas.
He shifted his gaze to the Cox brothers, who'd thumbed back their hats and stood drinking casually.
I guess you'll have to take that up with Sam when he gets back.
Mace walked over to the bar.
That guy over there is with the men I told you about.
They picked up their drinks and sauntered over and stood before Atticus. He didn't move or flinch or turn his gaze from theirs. Instead, his finger rested in the curve of the Winchester's trigger. The one with the scar was the first to speak up.
Mace here says you're looking to hire a couple of hands.
Atticus thought they looked so much alike it would have been hard to distinguish one from the other were it not for that scar.
Not me. Them I'm with do.
You ain't the hiring man then?
I ain't nothing but me.
The two of them exchanged puzzled looks.
Well, how come you say to Mace that you was looking to hire hands?
I didn't say nothing to Mace.
The one with the scar looked over his shoulder toward Mace, who now stood behind the bar with both palms planted atop its surface, then brought his look back around to Atticus.
You're either hiring or you ain't.
Atticus considered the fella more than stupid, the way some fellas are, of low education and no ambition to get any smarter. Men who are content to live simply and without complications. Men who are visceral in their behavior, whose words are based upon mood and not reason. Such men were not to be fooled with unless you were prepared to fight them at the drop of a hat. Such men were constantly ready to kill at the slightest provocation, and sometimes with no provocation at all. The Cox brothers were the sort of men who lived hand to mouth, getting by on what they could beg, borrow, or steal. They more than likely drank and fornicated every red cent they ever had, and lived in between with empty pockets, brooding and scheming. Such men were little different than the beasts they rode, roped, or slaughtered. And maybe not even as smart. Such men did not build railroads or empires. They were just a couple of common waddies, as far as Atticus could tell.
Ask you again, you hiring or ain't you?
Atticus shook his head negatively, only slightly, ready to blow them out of their boots, for he cared not a whit for either one of them.
I ain't. But he is.
Sam and the others came rattling through the doors just then. They came over and gathered around.
Mace! Two more bottles over here.
They all sat down at the table and palavered, with Sam Starr doing most of the negotiating. The Cox brothers seemed more than eager to pitch in with the gang for what Sam offered them. He finally introduced them.
Boys, this here is July and Wordell Cox. What sort of name is Wordell?
The brother without a scar narrowed his gaze.
It's one my mama gave me. You got a problem with it all of a sudden?
Ooh, just tested your fast. Here, have another glass.
How far is this woebegone place, this Red Pony, anyway? Never even heard of it.
It's a fare to Midland ride by train.
The Cox brothers had sandy hair, with sharply receding hairlines. They had faces like those of churlish youngsters with gray-green eyes that didn't seem to set right, as though each eye was looking off to the side. Wordell had buck teeth, but July had his front ones missing altogether. Another distinguishing feature along with the scar. They smelled of horse and sweat and had black dirt under their fingernails and in the creases around their eyes. July wore a silver pinky ring. They studied Black Bill as if he was some horse they were thinking about buying.
What are you?
I don't catch your meaning.
I mean, you an Injun or mix or what exactly?
I'm a killer's all you need to know about me.
Bill calmly lifted his glass and drained it. July slapped the table.
Woohoo! Goddamn!
Shorty sat with his arms crossed over his chest, studying them.
I met you boys once over in Tulsa.
Oh, yeah? When was that?
5-6 years ago. He was working punchers and got into a terrible big row in a bar there. Shot some fellas, then fled.
We was never in Tulsa, goddammit.
I bet they still got warrants for you over that way.
What you trying to prove, mister?
Nothing, just saying.
Say nothing, and you'll be all right.
Say shit, and you'll be all right.
That's enough. We didn't come here to start a fight.
An unsettling silence befell them, every man ready to pull the trigger if provoked further. But in the end, money spoke much louder than any words or any grievances they might carry one for the other. They were uneasy badgers locked in a cage of their own making, one constructed of greed and ignorance and murderous inclinations.
We leave on the noon flyer tomorrow. Be down at the train depot in time.
Could use a little taste of that sugar now.
Sam Starr gave him $100. He was feeling most generous, knowing there would always be more where that came from. The money was an investment in the killing of John Henry Cole and any who rode with him. Sometime during the dead of night, they all drifted away and into sleep down at the local hotel. Atticus dreamed of far-off, calmer places where the wind whispered through the corn and moths fluttered in the light of windows and crickets chirped in the dark. He saw himself surrounded by strangers and blood letters and felt as if he was different from them somehow, even though he knew for certain that he was indeed one of them, and maybe the worst of them. He didn't know if he could ever make his way back to that place of his youth where the wind whispered through the corn and crickets chirped in the night. They woke with heavy heads and made their way to the depot, where they lounged like lazy cats while awaiting the sharp shriek of the flyer. And soon enough, the train arrived.
Come on, let's go. To our glory.
No one man among them knew what the hell exactly Sam was talking about, but it didn't matter. Before having left town, Sam Starr wired Marshal Lou Ford of Red Pony a cryptic telegram. Ford kept rereading it as he paced in his office.
We'll arrive in 5 days' time. Stop. Let Cole know to be there and ready for a fight. Stop. Else you and the rest shall suffer. Stop.
Marshal Ford was a giant of a man who stood well over 6 feet 4 inches tall and had to duck under most doorways to enter a room. He neither drank, nor smoked, nor chewed tobacco. He was faithful to his wife Katie and had been married to her for 20 years. They had moved 24 times during their marriage because of Lou's search for a better job. He had prospected and worked in a lumber yard and traded horses. He had clerked in a store and apprenticed as a barber, something he didn't care a whit about. He attended bar and worked as a shotgun messenger for Wells Fargo. He had worked for a time as a bank guard. No work had seemed to suit him, and he was forever in search of a job that did. It wasn't until Lou answered an advertisement for a town marshal in Red Pony that he found his calling and eventually was offered the job. He had been on the job for nearly 3 years by the time the bad business with John Henry Cole and his men came to pass. Lou Ford knew Cole and liked the man, as he did the others who worked for him. Lou also liked the fact that they were manhunters, and like any hunter, kept the game farther and farther out and away from Red Pony, which made Lou's job that much easier and safer. Lou Ford didn't care much about going after outlaws, wished in fact they didn't exist at all. His badge alone seemed enough to exert his authority in most local disputes. Besides, he was good with his fists in case he needed them, and sometimes he did need them to break up a drunken fight. He could hit like a mule, and after a while, word got around, and troublemakers soon gave him his due when he waded in among them. It was a nice, clean life, and Lou Ford planned to live long enough to be able to retire. Katie was a member of the Presbyterian Church, and sang in the choir, and volunteered at the infirmary, and taught at the school. She and other women of the church held pie dances and picnics and such, and did what they could to help make Red Pony a decent place to live. She urged Lou to rid the place of the bad element. Not that there was that much there, just one bawdy house and 3 working girls to satisfy the needs of ranch hands and cowpunchers when they came to town. Lou explained to her that it was easier to control men if they were allowed their vices, and that as long as no real trouble started, it was better to allow a little gambling and whoring and some drinking than to try to cut it off altogether. Katie did not fully buy Lou's reasoning, but Lou was her husband, and her beliefs called for her to obey her husband, and so she did, but without enthusiasm when it came to certain things. The telegram, when it arrived, was not unexpected, but it was depressing. Lou's good life seemed threatened, his and Katie's and the rest of the town folks, most of whom Lou considered friends. He read the telegram many times over as he paced in his small office there on Main Street. Soon enough, word would spread all over town, from mouth to mouth, because Donnelly, the telegrapher, would spread it. The town council and others would be pounding on his door, demanding to know what he was going to do about it. What could he do about it? Lou went home.
What's wrong, dear?
Sam Starr gang sent me a telegram. Said they're going to show up and start shooting innocent people, and there's nothing I can do to stop it.
Let's pray about it, Lou.
What good will praying about it do? God won't stop them. You might think that he will, but he won't.
Lou, have you lost your faith in our Lord Jesus?
I never had it. I thought I had it there for a while, but I didn't.
Lou Ford held a very deep, dark secret from long years past, long before he ever met Katie. The secret resided in him like a black tumor. He tried hard not to think of it, and sometimes could go for weeks and weeks without the cloud of it darkening his thoughts. But then something, usually from some little innocuous incident, would make him think about it, and his mood would plummet, and he'd have to struggle hard to get it back up again. Now, with the telegram in his hand, he felt the darkening of his mood again. Felt as if, because of his sinful secret, he was having to pay, perhaps with his life this time, for what he'd done so many years ago.
I was just a wiseacre kid. What did I know about anything? And haven't I been decent ever since? Ain't I tried?
He knew that he could just quit and leave, of course, start over. He and Katie were getting on in years, no longer young, but maybe they could start over.
Maybe we ought to pack up and get out of here.
She looked at him with her startled china blue eyes.
Lou, what are you talking about? We can't leave our home. These good folks who've come to be our friends, my duties at the church and the school.
You're right. I don't know what I was thinking about.
Her face relaxed.
It will be fine, Lou. Things will work out, you'll see. Jesus will send us an answer to all this mess, and things will be fine.
He went out again and found his two deputies eating lunch in the cafe and sat down between them.
Boys, we got trouble brewing.
What sort of trouble, Lou?
He showed them the telegram.
Keep this to yourselves.
First Jim Dander read it, and then Hal Biggs read it. Troubled looks gathered in their faces.
Well, we sort of figured it might come to this, didn't we, Lou?
Sort of did, I reckon. But now it's no longer simply an idle threat. They're actually coming.
Hal Biggs scratched behind his ear, tipping his hat forward, then readjusted it so it didn't set so low over his eyes.
Boy, I don't see how I can do this for $50 a month.
Biggs wiped his mouth with his napkin. Suddenly his stew didn't taste so good. The thought of getting a bullet, maybe in the belly, just raised the bile in him.
Reckon I'll have to resign, Lou. Just not up to such violence as what it seems is promised in that telegram.
You can't quit.
Yeah, I don't see how you can stop me.
Jim, too, had already made up his mind and took off his badge and set it beside his coffee cup.
No, Lou. I've got them three kids I'm having to raise since Mary Lee's been gone. What would them kids do without a daddy now that they've lost their mother?
I'll ride out and explain it to John Henry. He's a man of honor. He'll understand.
Hal Biggs unpinned his badge, too, and set it next to Jim's.
Yeah, maybe he will. Maybe he won't, Lou. He was smart. He'd ride clean to Canada and cross the border and stay there. That's what I'd do, was I him?
I can't believe you're both quitting me in my hour of need.
I reckon each of us got to do whatever's best.
You ought to quit, too, Lou. You and Katie clear out while you can. Let someone else handle this mess.
Lou could see that girl plain as day now. How he and those other two boys had gotten her up in the barn that day when her daddy was gone off to town. Her name was Sylvia, and she was not the prettiest thing around, but she'd been sweet on Lou and lived just up the road from him. They'd started sneaking off and going down to the creek and hiding in the tall grass, and he remembered what she'd said to him one day before their first time.
I'll give it to you, Lou. I'll take off my dress and give it to you if you want me to.
He'd never before lain with a gal, but he was in that age when a boy knows to rut and gets all fevered up. And if he's lucky, there's a gal he can get to rut with, such as Sylvia was with him that day and other days subsequently. It was a thing to brag about to his two best friends, Zeke Haskell and Roy Shepherd. He told them about it in great detail, and they got after him to let them fool with it too. Just the thought of it knotted in his throat, sitting there with his now ex-deputies. How she looked so frightened when they all three got her in that barn up in the haymow and had her surrounded.
I don't want to.
You're gonna have to, Sylvia.
All three of us.
No, I refuse. Just let me go. I won't tell.
Sylvia, listen. It don't make no difference whether it's just me or me and my friends too. Fornicating is fornicating. Don't you see the reason in it?
No, I don't see it that way. Please, just let me go, Lou.
It's just this one time. Just this one time, Sylvia.
No, Lou. Just leave me alone.
But then it was way too late, for they'd unloosed the straps to their coveralls and were all fevered up, their brains on fire with lust. They took her hands and rubbed them on themselves. When she tried to scream, Zeke had fallen upon her, his hand clasped over her mouth, and then Roy had got her by the legs and held her. Lou had felt unable to move at first, then he'd begun to tremble. Lou watched the other two take what they wanted.
Your turn, Lou.
No, let her go.
We will, as soon as you take your turn.
I don't want no turn.
Hell, I guess you don't, since you've already been getting it. But this time, you take your turn, so in case she blames me and Zeke, she'll have to blame you, too.
No.
You either do it, or we're gonna beat the hell out of you and pitch you off this hayloft and listen to your damn bones break. Then we'll pitch her off, too.
So he had done it. It had been bad enough. He had done it, and they had watched. but he had half enjoyed doing it. That was the worst part. And when he'd finished, they'd laughed and warned the girl not to say anything or else they'd come back and take it out on her again, only this time worse. Then those two had left, and Lou and she had been alone, and he had to look into her red, swollen eyes. They'd torn her dress, and blood was smeared on her legs.
I'll make it up to you, Sylvia. I swear I will.
But he'd never got that chance, because a week later, she'd hanged herself in that same barn. After Lou had found out about it, he had gone and found Roy and Zeke and waylaid them. He busted them good with a length of oak limb, cursing them as he'd beaten them, busted teeth and broke noses. He made them pay, but there was no kind of pay that would make up for what they'd done. It had been the blackest moment of his life and not one he could ever get over. And that was a pitiful feeling, to do something you could never forget and never get over. Something that you carried around inside you and was a scar on your soul. So he'd run away, hopped a freight train, and several more, until he was so far from home he figured nobody would ever find him again. He hated running. And now it looked as if he had to run away again, or stand and fight and probably die for something or someone he had little truck with. It sure enough seemed like his sin had caught up to him. Lou sat there staring at the badges. Jim Dander and Hal Biggs had gone during Lou's reverie about what had happened. He felt now as alone and fearful as Sylvia must have felt up in that barn, with boys setting upon her. The vision of her blood-streaked thighs sickened him even now.
Buck up! Buck up! Do what you gotta do, but do it quick.
He stood, began to walk out, and saw himself in the plate glass window as he passed by, a watery reflection of a troubled man. He went to the livery and got his horse and rode forth, perhaps on a fool's mission. The wind was cold and sharp, cutting across the flatland, so that Lou had to put his collar up and tuck his chin down into his coat. It made him feel small and even frail, like a kid, like that boy again. Her blood dried and sticking to his hands, and the blood of his two friends that he later beat with the tree limb seemed not to have ever washed from his mind.
What are you capable of, Lou? Murder? Maybe. Well, there's only one person who can help you. John Henry Cole. You have to convince him to come back and offer himself up to Sam Starr and his gang. To sacrifice himself to save the town. You can do it. You can talk him into it. Explain how a man should do the right thing, even if it costs him personally. You know, don't you, Lou, what it's like to do a shameful act and be forever sorry for it. Well, that's what John Henry Cole would be doing if he tucked tail and ran off and didn't face down the Star Gang. You tell him, without going into the details, how, if he doesn't do the right thing, he'll have to live with that shame all his life.
He put the horse into an easy lope. It was cold, and he had a two-day ride ahead of him. That night, Franzetta got Charlie alone while the others were outside. Cole and Tom were talking. Old Pablo was getting drunk on the whiskey Cole had given him, and Preacher Man was off by himself, meditating.
Listen, Charlie, I want us to get out of here as soon as possible.
Where do you want us to go, Franny?
I don't care. Anywhere but here.
You afraid Sam Starr will come and find us here?
I'm not afraid of anything. I just don't want to stay here any longer.
Charlie sat on the side of the bed, his crutches crossed upon his lap.
I love you, Franny. Love you to death. But I got to stand by John Henry.
Oh, don't be a damn fool!
This surprised Charlie, her sudden anger. He didn't understand where it was coming from.
I'm no fool. Leastways, not about this.
Franzetta's fists were balled so tightly her knuckles showed white.
You don't understand.
Understand what? What is it that's eating you?
Oh, nothing. Damn it. Just nothing at all.
I need some night air.
Charlie hobbled out, leaning on his crutches and silently cursing his wounds for making him seem old and feel so feeble. Light from inside the house spilled out onto the ground, and it was enough light for the men outside to see about them. Preacher Man was now nearest the window in order to read his Bible. Charlie paused outside and stood looking off at the star-salted sky and the scar of a moon, the night wind creating a chill. Smoke from Cole's cigarette blew upward and spread like wraiths looking for their ethereal home.
I don't know what the hell is wrong with that woman. She's twisting me like a fresh-washed shirt.
She doesn't want to see you killed, Charlie. She's afraid of losing you.
Is that it?
Tom squatted on his heels nearby, playing mumbly peg with a bone-handled clasp knife. He had become lost in his own thoughts, and Cole just let him be, figuring the boy was still wrestling with his emotions, either over the death of his mother or shooting that fellow up in Lusk. In fact, Cole was a bit concerned about what might happen based upon what the sheriff had said. But then you never knew when it came to hard case types, whether they were bragging or meant it.
What do you want to do, Charlie? You want to leave? If so, Preacher Man can drive you and Franzetta somewhere. I think she's right in wanting you to go if that's what's got you upset. Can't blame her for that. You're not letting me down if you're worried about it.
I know it. Where the hell that old Mix go?
Out there somewhere. Was just here, but he comes and goes like the night wind. Why are you asking?
I was hoping to get a taste of that liniment. You got another bottle stored somewhere?
Nope. Don't keep it except for old Pablo.
My nerves are raw. That's the only reason I could use a drink.
Preacher Man looked up from his reading and marked his place with a piece of red ribbon.
You want to leave with your wife? I'm glad to take you.
She wants to go real bad.
We can leave in the morning if you want.
Let you know then, if it's all right. I'll talk to her some more.
Tom stood, folding his blade and putting the knife in a front pocket of his dungarees. Cole could tell the boy was now restless as all get out, like a wild young horse caught by a rope, knowing somebody was going to try and break it, and knowing it wouldn't let itself be broke.
Hell, why don't we just go find those sons of bitches and take care of them?
Cole realized then, perhaps really for the first time, that Tom was every bit his equal, and the equal to any man among them. It was a harsh reality. Tom turned to face Cole.
Well, nothing. I'll decide when and where, but you stay out of it.
He saw the look on his boy's face then, a mixture of disappointment and anger. It seemed like everybody was getting slightly on edge. Then a rider appeared out of the night.
Oh, Jesus, look what the cat dragged in.
Lou Ford halted his mount.
John Henry, Charlie?
You've come for supper. You're too late, Lou.
Get on down, Lou.
Tom stood staring, and so too did Preacher Man. Lou Ford dismounted.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news again, John Henry.
Speak plain.
Lou handed him the telegram, and Cole tilted it toward the light and read it, then handed it back to Lou.
You want me and Charlie to come back and face him, is that it?
Lou stood, holding the reins of his horse, lightly tapping them into one gloved hand. Almost bashful, it seemed to Cole, like a man asking a girl to dance with him.
First you ask us to leave, then you ask us to come back.
It had been an irritating evening for Charlie thus far. The appearance of Lou Ford didn't help any.
I'm just asking you to do the right thing, Charlie. You and John Henry here.
The right thing being to get gunned down in order to save that town that wouldn't stand behind us when we needed them?
Lou shifted his weight uneasily at the accusation because he knew it to be true.
I'm just one fella. Hell, I don't even have any deputies. Dander and Biggs quit soon as they saw this. I imagine they've taken their families earning the next county by now.
Well, that about puts you in the jackpot now, don't it, Lou?
Yeah, you can abuse me all you want. It's not going to change a thing.
You hungry, Lou?
I reckon I could stand to eat a biscuit if it had bacon lard smeared on it and a cup of coffee before I head back.
Tom, would you go and ask Franzetta to fix Lou here something to eat and get him a cup of coffee?
Tom was anxious to do something. Inside the cabin, Franzetta was packing a bag for her and Charlie, filling it with the few things they'd brought.
John Henry wanted me to ask you if you'd fix up something for this fellow outside to eat, make him a cup of coffee.
She looked at Tom, saw a young version of John Henry Cole, and his handsomeness swept through her like a wild wind.
What fellow?
Some fella named Lou is all I know.
Lou Ford from Red Pony?
I reckon that's who he is.
What'd he say he came here for?
Said he wanted John Henry and Charlie to come back to Red Pony. Reckon that's what?
The color drained from her already pale face.
Come back.
Tom shifted his weight. She reminded him a little of his mother, a good-looking woman with a carriage that suited her, and one that would draw a man's attention. Not that he knew much about women, since he surely did not.
That's all I know.
He went out again, wanting to learn more about the situation. Franzetta sat down on the bed, holding her face in her hands and trying not to weep.
Sin, sin, sin. Are we all paying for our sins? Charlie for his, John Henry for his, and me for mine.
She bit her lower lip.
How is it we pray and say we believe and tell ourselves that God watches over us and will protect us, and yet at the first sign of serious trouble we doubt, as I'm doubting now?
It seemed to Franzetta that faith was the most fragile of things, thin as an eggshell, as elusive as love itself. It seemed like God was only present when things were good. She tried to tell herself that Charlie and John Henry would not be killed if they faced down the Sam Starr gang, but she knew that they would be, and that she would not only find herself a widow, but that her truest love, John Henry, would exit this world without ever knowing how much she cared for him. It seemed such a shame, such a crying shame. For a long moment, she gave in to her fears, and then, as she'd always done in the past when things got their toughest, she steeled herself, wiped her eyes, stood, and went forth. She fixed a biscuit with some salted ham on it and a cup of coffee and walked outside to give it to Lou Ford. Lou looked at her with a hangdog expression that became even more hangdog when she handed him the sandwich and coffee.
Lou?
He took it without speaking, for he knew what she had to be thinking.
Charlie's not going back with you, Lou.
Still, he said nothing, but merely looked at Charlie, who was himself looking a little forlorn. Then she looked at Cole.
You're responsible for this. You tell Charlie he can't go with you. You order him to stay here with me.
That's enough, woman!
She stood hugging herself against the cold, against the fright, then turned and ran back into the cabin.
Let me go talk to her, Charlie.
I wish you would.
Cole found her sitting on the bed, trembling.
Franzetta?
She instantly jumped up and threw her arms about his neck and pressed herself to him.
It's you, John Henry. It's you I'm most worried about.
Her tears dampened the side of his face, her grip as strong as if he were saving her from drowning. He pulled her away and looked at her.
I don't understand what this is about.
I've kept it long hidden. My feelings for you.
He held up a hand.
Much as I appreciate that, it can't be. You're Charlie's wife.
We could go away. Just ride clean out of the territory and not look back. We could go to Arizona or maybe California, just the two of us. John Henry, it's what I want. What I've always wanted now that I've had time to think about it. Now that I've seen you again.
No. No, I couldn't ever do that to Charlie. And I can't allow you to either.
Suddenly she tensed.
Me? You don't have a say over me or what I want or don't want. If I want to leave Charlie, I will.
Not with me.
He turned on his heel and walked back outside again.
Well, you get her calmed down?
I think so. The hell, I'm not rightly sure.
Women.
Tom stood idly by with his hands slipped down into the back pockets of his jeans, ready to go to a fight. He didn't know why he even cared about his father and his troubles, or Charlie either. But his father had walked him away from trouble in Lusk, and truth be told, Tom would like to find out John Henry's full story before he rode away. This man who he looked so much like. This man whose blood ran through his veins, whether either of them liked it or not.
Yeah, women.
Lou Ford tossed out the dregs of his coffee.
What y'all gonna do?
We'll let you know.
Well, can't force you to come.
That's right, Lou. You can't force us to do nothing.
Lou nodded, mounted his horse, tugged down his hat so low it bent the tops of his ears over, then turned the horse about and headed back the way he'd come, trusting the animal to make its way in the dark.
There goes a rather lonesome and troubled man.
You got anything in that holy book to tell us what we ought to do?
Take out thy sword and smite thine enemies left and right. And Samson roared, "With the jaw of an ass I have slain 1,000 men. Seems to me you all should be able to finish off one lowly gang of criminals and miscreants.
Charlie looked at Preacher Man as if he was daft.
Now where the hell are we going to find the jaw of an ass?
He turned his gaze quickly to Preacher Man's pair of Missouri mules.
That bastard kid ruined me. He ruined me forever. I can't walk. I can't even feel my legs. Christ, bring me some whiskey, woman.
Benetta had begun to contemplate life with T-Bone, with him now a cripple and she still a young and viable woman. What would she have to do if she stayed with him? Wait on him hand and foot? Be his nursemaid? Tote him around in a wheelbarrow?
I want him dead. Go and find Duck Leslie and get him to come here.
So she went in search of Leslie, a man she had seen around and whose reputation was that of a lowbrow rumored to have killed men for hire. He was first and foremost an ugly man, tall and thin with a beak of a nose, loose-lipped mouth, and weak chin. Always a sign, Vanetta thought, of perversion, weak chins. Duck was known to hold court up the street at the Three Aces Cattleman's Emporium. The place was patronized by weaklings and miscreants, layabouts and out-of-work cowboys. There wasn't a man worth a spit among them, she judged. And there at the far end of the bar stood Duck Leslie. He was hard to miss because of his height, and the sombrero he wore made him seem even taller than he was.
Duck?
Duck straightened to his full height from leaning on his elbows and eyed her suspiciously. He was suspicious of women in general, and most especially those who came into saloons looking for him. The last one who had claimed she had a baby growing in her that was his. He had ridden a fast horse out of that town and landed here in Lusk.
Yeah?
T-Bone wants you to come and see him.
He looked down at her with his hooded eyes as though he was too lazy or stupid to open them all the way. She'd never seen such an ugly man. He was dressed in a buckskin shirt and corduroy trousers that were soiled, and a black and white cowhide vest with most of the hair worn off. At his waist, he sported a pair of ivory-handled pistols, stuck in a wide leather belt that reminded Vanetta of a saddle cinch, and had a large red scarf draped around his neck that probably hadn't been washed in 4 years.
God, but ain't you a pimp?
I take offense at you, madam.
You can take it however you please. I don't give a rat's ass.
Then I decline your invitation.
You can decline anything you want, but I reckon you'd be an ignoramus if you did so without first hearing his offer.
Now, Duck Leslie lived mostly on the generosity of lesser men who wanted to hear all about his adventures with such as Wild Bill Hickok and Texas Jack Omohundro. Duck Leslie could spin a yarn as good as some women could spin wool. The cost of admission was one drink per set of ears doing the listening.
Offer? What sort of offer?
Jesus and Mary, I'm not going to stand around in this outhouse and palaver with you. You want to come? Come. I'll stay here and bedazzle these oafs and laggards.
Vanetta turned and stalked out.
Hold on there, little sister.
He caught up to Vanetta outside. She didn't bother to slow down or wait, but continued forth at a rapid pace back to the little house she rented with T-Bone. Duck liked the looks of the woman from behind, so he slowed his pace in order to watch her all the way to the house. T-Bone was propped up in his bed with a stack of stained pillows. His eyes rolled toward them.
Well, it's about time you two showed up. What you been up to behind my back?
Jesus.
Vanetta went back out again, leaving Duck Leslie and T-Bone to their own devices.
What can I do for you?
I got a proposition for you.
Yeah, and what would that be?
Close that door. I don't want her hearing.
Duck Leslie closed the door.
Now sit down here close to me so I can talk low.
Duck scraped a chair over to the bedside and sat and wrinkled his nose at the sick smell of T-Bone, a combination between an outhouse and an apothecary.
I'll pay you $200 to track down that kid which shot me and put one in his skull.
Duck straightened as if he had a twitch in his backbone.
Where'd someone like you get $200?
Now you don't worry about that. You want the damn money or not.
And all I gotta do is track this kid down and shoot him?
That's it. 100 now, and the other 100 when the job's done.
How am I supposed to find one kid in all this country?
Easy. I had Vanetta go question RT on it. He gave up the goods on that fella. Told her their names and where they're from. Not more than 10 miles from here.
How you know I won't just take the money and abscond with it?
Abscond? That's a mighty big word, Duck. You even know what it means?
I know what it means.
Because if you was to abscond with it, I'd just hire a killer to track you down and kill you is what.
Duck Leslie scratched his neck, and then his crotch, and then up under one arm.
Deal. Killing don't mean nothing to me. All I've ever done in my life is kill people. Killing for money's the easiest thing I've ever done.
T-Bone reached under the sheets for the money he'd stolen from Vanetta's hidden cash, her whoring money that she'd been saving for over a year. She'd planned on putting together a nice fat steak and then clearing out of the country and starting a new life. She knew how to play the piano, and maybe she could teach such skills to children for a fee, become a prim and proper lady, and maybe marry a man who wore celluloid collars and neckties and scraped mud off his shoes before he came into the house. She'd had to screw a lot of drovers and teamsters and assorted other types for that money, and as soon as she found it missing, she'd go crazy, T-Bone knew. She was a damned wildcat of a woman when her dander got up, and might even stab him in the heart, where she'd learn it was he who took her stake. Well, he wasn't going to tell her, and he made sure to swear Duck Leslie to secrecy as well.
She asked what I wanted to see you for. Make something up. You're good at lying.
Sure, no skin off my teeth.
You come back with a newspaper clipping saying you killed that kid, you get the rest of the money.
Let me ask you something.
What's that?
Supposing you were to die while I'm gone, how am I gonna get the rest of my money?
I ain't gonna die, you damn twit. I look like I'm gonna die to you.
You look mighty peaked. I've seen men die who don't look near as peaked as you do.
Oh, Christ. I guess it's just a gamble you're gonna have to take. You want that damn money or not? If not, give it back and I'll find me someone else for the job, and you can go back to begging for drinks and telling your damn lies.
Duck suddenly pulled one of his pistols and cocked it and put the muzzle to T-Bone's skull.
Maybe I ought to blow you out of that bed and go fuck that woman of yours and take all your money. How'd that be?
T-Bone thumbed back the hammer on a little double-shot derringer he also kept under the sheets.
Well, I reckon you'd rather not die even more than me. I'm halfway to Hades already. Your choice. A bullet in your balls or the money?
Duck lowered the hammer on his piece and grinned, a row of blunt yellow teeth trapped within those rubbery lips of his.
Shit, T-Bone, I was only jaking you.
Well, don't jake me no more, if you know what's good for you.
Duck stood clumsily and tugged down his sombrero and strode out of the room. Vanetta was there by the front window, looking out, smoking a cheroot, the smoke wreathing around her head, the light filtering through her thin dress so that he could see the shape of her, and it caused him to lick his lips like a dog expecting to be tossed a pork bone with some meat still on it. He walked up to her.
You're a fine-looking woman. How much for a toss?
She looked at him, ugly as he was. Still, business was business, and she could use every red cent she could earn to add to her hidden money.
For you, $10. And no lingering one either. 5 minutes to get your gun off or else.
$10? Hell, that's twice the going rate. I can get up the street from any whore in town for $5.
Then go up the street and get it. In 3 days from now, when you can't squeeze a drop of water without it feeling like razor blades coming out the end of your pizzle, you'll be wishing you never heard of them claptraps.
Duck knew she wasn't lying. He'd heard of how syphilitic most of Lusk's whores were. Almost everybody in Lusk knew to stay clear of them, but the outside cowboys and drummers traveling through were ignorant of the fact, and so the chippies continued to do a tolerable business.
Well, where do you want to do it?
The only bed was the one in which T-Bone lay stricken.
How about just up against the wall here? But I want my money before you put it in.
Suits me.
Duck unwittingly gave Vanetta 10 of her own dollars back.